Today on Against the Grain, capitalism appears to many to be a failed system, leading to extreme inequality and ecological devastation. We're also told that the alternative posed by Karl Marx is similarly bankrupt, as proved by the failures of state socialism. But what if Marx's vision for a post-capitalist future has little in common with the experience of the Soviet Union and China? I'm Sasha Lilly. Peter Hudis argues that freedom, including from a repressive state apparatus, was central to Marx's concept of life after capitalism. I'll speak with him in just a moment. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We live in starkly anti-utopian times. The idea of transforming our world for the better in any thoroughgoing way seems to be entirely off the table. In fact, we're just bracing for things to get worse. We're frequently told that to try to change the world systematically will lead to a dead end, like the dismal societies of the Soviet Union and China under state socialism. Marxism, in particular, can't point the way forward, we hear, because of its doctrinaire notion that individual freedom should be discarded for some idea of the greater good. But today's guest argues that this gets Marx entirely wrong. His vision of life after capitalism was based on individual and collective liberation, and much of it remains unknown to both the detractors and supporters of radical politics alike. Peter Hudis is professor of humanities and philosophy at Oakton Community College and the author of Marx's Concept of the Alternative to Capitalism, published by Haymarket. Peter, beyond the rote ideas about capitalism being followed by socialism and then communism, can you explain why there's an assumption that Marx had little to say about life after capitalism?
So there's three connected issues here. Is that one, we have to keep in mind that Marx was responding, when he formulated his ideas and developed it beginning in the 1840s, he's responding to a certain way of approaching both socialism as a movement and a conception of what a socialist society is on the part of utopian socialists who are inventing conceptions of a new society out of the head of intellectuals without any regard for the material conditions or a study of them that would make an achievement of a socialist society possible. So Marx has a reason to be very wary of speculative utopian blueprints about the future and imposing them irrespective of the movement of history. Because after all, Marx's main critique of capitalism is that in capitalism, products of human activity take on a life of their own, and then they dominate and control the subject irrespective of their will. If he is just going to throw out notions out of his own head of what a social society ought to look like, he's kind of doing the same thing. He's imposing a conception of what people ought to become, irrespective of studying the imminent movement within reality that can achieve a transformation of existing conditions as defined by the subjects involved in that process of liberation themselves. So he has an understandable reason to be wary about utopian speculation, and I don't deny the virtue and the value of that. But the second aspect is that Marx is living at a time when there has not yet been a failed or an aborted revolution. Right? It's a very early period of the workers' movement in Europe. There is a successful revolution of sorts in Marx's lifetime in Europe, the Paris Commune of 1871. It's crushed, but it's crushed from the outside by counter-revolutionary forces. So it wouldn't have appeared that necessary to the socialists of his generation, including himself, to specify explicitly what concept of socialism is needed to distinguish itself from what would be considered wrong variants of socialism that would consume or limit or even destroy a revolution from the inside. So in other words, Marx didn't live to see Stalinism, where socialist dedicated revolutionaries actually helped create a monstrous totalitarian society that negated all the values that Marxism had upheld for generations. So that reality makes it much more imperative to make explicit what is implicit in Marx's work, which brings me to the third point. Though Marx was not trying to write an extensive explanation of what the new society looks like, for the reasons I outlined just briefly, it's really not very plausible that he can have the kind of coherent critique of capitalism that he has unless he has some sort of conception, even if it's only general, of what life would be like given the abolition of capitalism. That is, how do you know what's wrong with wage labor? How do you know what's wrong with class society? How do you know what's wrong with alienation? Unless you have a sense that it damages something fundamental about the human person and the human personality. That is, unless it blocks human capability. And so Marx had to have a sense of that human capability that is being blocked by capital in order to issue a critique of capital in the first place. So within his work, what I have argued is you can find numerous indications where he expresses his conception of what human capability would be like in the absence of a society dominated by capital. And that conception very much guides a lot of his critique of capital. He may not have made it explicit. He never wrote a book about it. He never outlined it in a major treatise. But there's many, many places in Marx's work, when you start to put it all together, fragmentary as some of it is, where you see an underlying view of what a socialist or communist future would be like, which is remarkably distinctive from the state socialist type of experiments that we saw in the 20th century.
Right, and that seems to be what gives this book its urgency, in the sense that you're arguing that Marx had a vision which is very different than the vision that we have come to inherit as the conventional wisdom of what socialism or communism would look like. And key to that, or at least central to that difference, is the notion of freedom. And that's a term, of course, that we hear a lot of in the U.S., actually, especially on the American right. But what did freedom mean for Marx?
Yes. One of the problems with the development of Marxism is that much of Marx's work, especially his most important philosophical work, where he really developed the basis of his later economic critique of capitalism, was not known until, you know, the middle 20th century. In other words, the Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts of 1844, the Draft of Capital, the Grundrisse, other works of his were not even published until, well, not the 1844 manuscripts, didn't even appear in German until the 1930s. It wasn't in English until 1959 or so. So whole generations were raised without really seeing the depth of Marx's concept of freedom, because after all, the content of Capital, which is his greatest book, the three volumes of Capital, is fundamentally a critique of capitalist production. It's not a book about the human capacity for freedom explicitly. It's trying to prove and demonstrate his case that capitalism is a non-viable social system that is doomed to self-destruction. And that's the case that he makes very profoundly and very well, and makes it an indispensable work for anyone who is concerned with the issues of modern society. But the question is that when you look at these other writings that were not studied or not known by earlier generations, we see a very, very deep concept of freedom that's very different from liberal concepts of liberal democracy or formal political democracy, and certainly very different than the conservative notions of individual, atomized individual freedom, or freedom from what we call negative freedom, which is how freedom is basically defined in the U.S., historical tradition. For Marx, freedom is the ability to exercise your creative capacities of self-expression and human sociality. So freedom for Marx is the, as it was for thinkers that preceded him, such as Hegel, and indeed you can take it all the way back to Aristotle, is the conception of the realization or the actualization of the capacities that your human nature or our species being provides us to achieve conscious, purposeful, creative action. And the freedom for him, therefore, is the freedom to develop that creative capacity, which is endemic to all human beings, to its maximum potential. And a lack of freedom signifies obstacles imposed by social structures that inhibit that expression of creative potential. And so that is really what his entire project was about. He earlier said in one of his earliest writings, had made a very, I think, poignant statement when he wrote that freedom is so much the essence of humanity that nobody opposes freedom, they only oppose the freedom of others. In other words, there's no way not to be for freedom. Even the press censor who censors other people's right to freedom of expression is imposing his freedom at the expense of others, right? A totalitarian state is unfree, but it demands its freedom to prevent other people from being free. So Marx's conception, what he's drawing from this kind of statement, is freedom is part of human nature. To be free is part of our capacity for conscious, purposeful creation. And what inhibits that creation, however, is we enter into social relations in which human relations take on the form of relations between things. The products of labor dominate us in ways that we're not even conscious of very often, and that expression of freedom gets limited. But it's not a question of merely an individual type of freedom. It's a freedom of our social being. As he put it very poignantly, the freedom of each is the precondition for the freedom of all. You can't have the freedom of the individual without the freedom of all, and you can't have the freedom of all without the freedom of the individual. So Marx is also, I think, somebody who transcends this kind of separation of the individual versus the collective that you get in a lot of traditional social theory and politics.
Sure, and which was raised then as one of the criticisms of attempts to establish state socialist societies. But to say that the freedom of the individual can't exist without the freedom of the collective and then vice versa, that sounds very nice, but actually what does it mean in practice? Because it sounds, as you say, as it has been typically presented in philosophy and political science, that that's a contradiction.
Right. It's a contradiction that, this is one of the brilliant observations of his work, The Grundrisse. It's a contradiction because social structures have been formed in such a way as to make that that contradiction a necessity, and that only the transcendence of the specific social contradictions that cause antagonism between individuals and between individuals in their community is going to be able to overcome that situation. So in other words, a kind of a one-sided individualism and a kind of one-sided collectivism are, for Marx, opposite sides of the same coin. They're both a reflection of the fact that in modern society, the individual is alienated from civil society, right? In other words, the bonds that connect individuals to each other are fragmented and increasingly lose their cohesion precisely because of the alienation of labor. That is, when we become alienated from a very activity of laboring, which extends, of course, into other facets of our social existence, we become alienated not just from the products we produce or the amount of value we create, we also become alienated from the very activity of creating products, from a very activity of helping to reproduce social relations. That situation inevitably compels a separation and a breakdown between individuals and society itself. And the product of that is you're going to get kind of a one-sided individualism that wants to express the individual at the expense of the collective, but also you're going to get a one-sided collectivism that emphasizes collectivism at the expense of the individual. And the 1844 manuscripts, in his famous essay, Private Property and Communism, Marx explicitly goes after this when he says the problem of capitalism is not simply individual ownership of the means of production. He says equally destructive is what he calls, that's his term, the vulgar communist notion that the abolition of private property and the collectivization of social relationships by itself automatically delivers human emancipation. And he takes very, very sharp issue with that conception in that essay. Which is somewhat of a surprise to many people when they think that, well, but Marx was a communalist and a collectivist, right? He was against the individual notion of freedom. But he's actually arguing against both tendencies because they're both expressions of the same contradiction.
Peter Hudis is my guest. He is the author of Marx's Concept of the Alternative to Capitalism. That's published by Haymarket. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. You mentioned earlier that Marx's earlier writings didn't come to light to mid-20th century, so those involved in socialist or communist politics in the early half of the century would have actually not been exposed to them. One of the key concepts of that earlier work was the notion of alienation and transcending alienation, which is relevant here in thinking about how Marx pointed in various ways to a post-capitalist future. Can you define for us his concept of alienation and then explain how he then saw a society that overcame alienation?
The standard view of Marx, essentially, that you're going to get from people if they have not really seriously, deeply studied his work, especially Chapter 1 of Capital, which sets up much of his argument, but also this material you've discussed, the 1844 manuscripts and Grundrisse and other such works. The standard narrative is that Marx's critique of capitalism was basically one of unequal distribution of value. That is, the worker produces so much value because labor is a source of all value, but the laborer does not receive back the bulk of this value that they create in the form of wages and benefits. much of their value that they create is extrapolated by the capitalist as profit or surplus value, we call it, and it is literally stolen from them. So you have an unfair system of distribution where all the value is created by the laborers, but the laborers who create all the value receive very little in return, and therefore you have the existence of this class domination and social inequality, which increases exponentially as capitalism develops. Everything I mentioned is true. That's all in Marx, and that's all, unfortunately, true of capitalism. And we all know how that's becoming more and more true of capitalism every day. But that's not the heart of Marx's critique of capitalism. You can agree with that entire notion of the distribution of value as being unfair and inequitable, and all you have in the final analysis is a left-wing variant of classical political economy, what sometimes is called neo-Ricardian Marxism. You don't have Marx's theory of alienation, let alone his conception of a thoroughgoing overcoming of capitalism. Because Marx was not only questioning the alienation or the separation of the product from the producer, he's also questioning, and most of all questioning, what brings that or allows that phenomena to exist. And for him, what allows it to exist is the fact that labor is subjugated to a form of value or reduced or to a form of value production to begin with. It's not just that the workers produce more value than they get back in their wages. It's that they themselves are treated as nothing more than a source or a form of value. That is, the dignity or the humanity of the human subject matters less than the amount of profit that they simply produce, and it matters to capitalism merely as an end in itself. So that is the fundamental problem of capitalism. Is Marx is really asking himself, how is it that something like human labor can be reduced or measured solely in terms of a abstract monetary equivalent, that we say a worker's life is worth so much monetary value, and that is all that matters, that's the only side of the human subject that interests us, and everything else is, so to speak, secondary, and that we actually buy into this type of ideology and pursue the acquisition of abstract forms of monetary accumulation as a kind of self-sufficient end, an end in itself, regardless of its impact on our human personality and society. So Marx's theory of alienation centers on the notion of being alienated or separated from your very activity of creation, production, and reproduction. It's not just the product that you're separated from. You're separated from your own subjectivity in the process of being dominated by a drive to simply perform labor and other acts for the sake of increasing the quantity of monetary wealth. And so alienation from Marx seeps into every facet of social existence because of this alienation of labor. It begins in the labor process, but it extends throughout society as a whole, filters into the family, into human relations in society more generally, into communal relations. And ultimately, more and more of social life becomes commodified in this form. So to be very short about my answer to your question, as short as I can be, Marx does see that capitalism is a very exploitative system insofar as workers are being ripped off, not given the product of their labor, then denied the fruit of their labor. But Marx's critique of capitalism is not only a theory of exploitation. It's most of all a theory of alienation. When you're exploited, you're denied the fruit of your labor. When you're alienated, you're denied your very being. And that's what really is the problem of capitalism, is that capitalism is a kind of ontology. It's kind of a way of being in which the human, the humanity of the human being is denied for the sake of treating them solely as a source of monetary wealth. Much deeper critique of capitalism, therefore, than what people presume.
Right. So then bearing in mind that Marx saw the need to transcend this much more profound kind of alienation, and value production was central to that. What then is the political implications of that? I mean, clearly one can see it for capitalism, but how does that then allow us to reflect on the experience of state socialism in the 20th century and compare it to what we can sort of piece together as Marx's vision for a post-capitalist future?
The real thing that the Soviet-type societies focused on was really the first part of what I was talking about, that is, the inequities in the distribution of value. And they were basically held that a socialist revolution would consist of ameliorating or abolishing this inequality in the distribution of value by, first of all, getting rid of the capitalists, and then, of course, nationalizing industry, nationalizing property, and then redistributing social wealth in a presumably equitable manner, so that this discrepancy between the amount of value produced by the laborer and the amount of value that they receive back from society would be ended. So basically, it was a redistributive conception of socialism. But of course, this redistributive conception needs a powerful force to affect that redistribution, and that force is, of course, held to be the state. So basically, the notion that much of Orthodox Marxism adopted is that the state is kind of a neutral instrument that the working class has to seize through the mediation of a political party and impose its will upon society through the state. Of course, what we get from that is what we saw, the political formation in the Soviet Union and elsewhere, which was highly repressive and, in the final analysis, completely contrary to the wishes of the workers who helped put that revolution into being in the first place. The political implications of having the theory of alienation, however, is what they did not do in the Soviet-type societies is ever raise the question of how to transform the alienation of, or end the alienation of labor. Okay, that more qualitative side of the transformation was simply taken for granted. The nature of industrial production, for example, if you worked in a factory in the Soviet Union, what was the fundamental difference of working in a factory there in Moscow and working in one in Detroit? The only difference would be the ownership deed. The form of work, the nature of the labor process was basically the same. The only difference is that instead of working at the service of a private corporation, you're working at the service of the state, which is controlled, of course, by a political elite itself, which is not democratically accountable to the working class. So the implications of Marx's conception of abolishing value production itself is that you have to you have to create conditions that make it possible for the laboring populace to freely transform working conditions in such a way that they are no longer alienated conditions of labor, that they no longer feel not at home in their laboring activity. But that can only be achieved by the laborers themselves, who are given the freedom to reorganize their work apparatus. Because after all, if there is true economic democracy, and workers are allowed to choose their own managers, run their own cooperatives, decide how to organize their production process, it's very unlikely they would be voting themselves into alienation, okay? They would be instead trying to figure out ways to break down these hierarchies and forms of alienation within the workplace itself, and that would negate the foundation of value production to begin with. So you could not have such a system, however, emerge unless you had a thoroughly democratic system that was controlled from the bottom up by the rank and file. What got in the way of that in Orthodox Marxism, however, at least to much of it, was a kind of a shortcut approach that says, well, rather than that, we'll have a minority party that will seize power, as it were, even behind the backs of the masses in some cases, and will impose a social reconstruction upon them simply by nationalizing property and abolishing the free market. And what you get from that, I think, is not socialism at all. What you get is state form of capitalism or state capitalism. So Marx's theory of value and his critique of value production actually has some very profound political implications for avoiding that type of trajectory.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about life after capitalism and specifically how Karl Marx envisioned that future. I'm joined by the author of Marx's Concept of the Alternative to Capitalism, which is published by Haymarket. We have a link to their website on our website, againstthegrain.org. He's professor of humanities and philosophy at Oakton Community College. So when you have been discussing the way that Marx himself thought about life after capitalism and how, and the reality, contrasting it to the reality of state socialism, one of the things that immediately jumps to mind is how Marx conceived of the state, and that his notion was shaped both in theory and in practice by the experience of the Paris Commune in 1871. I wonder if you could talk about that, because in terms of reading Marx and hearing your take on how Marx understood socialism and communism, a lot of it actually sounds much more anarchist than most people would imagine with Marx. Can you talk about how he understood the state and perhaps contrast him to anarchists, including those who might have been his critics at the time, his contemporaries?
Good question. Marx's own views on this issue, like a lot of the things that Marx did, went through an evolution and a process of development. And one thing that is always remarkable when you actually study Marx's development is how constantly he was revising his thought and improving it and changing his mind when it was necessary due to circumstances. And probably on no issue is this more important than the state. Communist Manifesto, he basically says that the task is of communists and socialists is to take hold of state power and then use the state as an instrument to expropriate the exploiting classes and to introduce or impose a socialist reorganization of society. And that, of course, ever since has been the standard so-called Marxist model of what the nature of the state is. But as early as 1852 already, long before the Paris Commune in the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, Marx, looking at the experience of the taking over of the French state by this Napoleon III and thinking out the ramifications of it, begins to says so quite explicitly, that the task of the workers' movement cannot be reduced to taking over the estate, the existing state, but has to involve a fundamental transformation of that state, because the state itself is a product of class society, and one rises and falls with the other. Now, for most of his subsequent career, from then, the next 20 years, 1852 to the Paris Commune of 1871, Marx had many close relations with anarchists, actually, and a lot of the blood that's been spilled between Marxists and anarchists is, I think, rather unfortunate, because Marx had much more in common with many in the anarchist tradition, as has been presumed. And he also had many differences, but they weren't really all. The main fundamental difference that Marx had was not so much on the question of the state, which he believed, as much as the anarchists did, would not and could not exist within a socialist or communist society, that it would be abolished, had to be abolished in order to an effective socialist or communist society to be brought into existence. His argument more was whether you can have a wholesale dismissal of the state in the struggle to achieve a socialist or communist society. That is, he did not approve of what he considered abstract revolutionist demands that would negate or preclude the possibility of workers using existing state laws or state regulations to try to limit the worst abuses of capitalism. He certainly favored the struggle for a shorter working day and state legislation that would ensure a shorter working day. He didn't think that such struggles were diversionary from the overall goal of abolishing capital. On the contrary, he said once very famously that if the working class cannot be depended upon to fight for and maintain its fight for a better wage, how can it be entrusted to fight for a completely new society? And there he had differences with anarchists that he thought, which he said, were neglecting the importance of these mediatory struggles, these political aspect of the struggle for a new society. That is, sometimes skipping to revolution without the necessary reform that would also be a component part of it. But when the 1871 Paris Commune happens, Marx does shift even more radically his position on the state. And now he very emphatically states that the task is not to take over the existing state, but to smash it, and not to replace it with a better, more functioning state, as much as to suppress the power of the state in favor of the power of society. Because in the Paris Commune, the state kind of melted away. Right, there still was a government. There was still some sort of state apparatus. So it wasn't that the state was abolished. And that's going to be another difference that he has with the anarchists. He doesn't think that the state can be abolished by an act of will or immediately upon the first day of revolution, because the state is an expression of class domination. And until class domination is eliminated, the state's going to exist in some form. But the question is, in what form? And in the Paris Commune, he argues, it exists in a non-state form. That is, in class society traditionally, society, civil society, is dominated by a centralized state apparatus of one form or another. But what he sees, as suggested by the Paris Commune, is that the situation is reversed. The commune, the associated power of society, citizen assemblies, neighborhood assemblies, factory assemblies, etc., effectively run democratically the society and impose the will of society upon the state. And the state gets turned into more of an instrument rather than a force of domination over society. And that begins and he called it a non-state form, the Paris Commune, even though, of course, it had a state, but the form of governments was non-statist in the sense that the freely associated decisions of civil society actually dominate over this hierarchical functions of the state apparatus. And that represents something that, in many respects, does converge Marx much closer with the anarchist position. But the irony was, of course, is that it's exactly then that his fight with the anarchists broke out most powerfully into the open, because only a year later, Bakunin, the leading anarchist of the time, had organized a secret faction within the First International, quite undemocratically, I should mention. That is, it was a secret faction. He joined the International in 1869 on the condition that there would be no separate faction that he would control within it. He went ahead and did it anyway, Bakunin. And when this was discovered, of course, he was called out on this by Marx and others for effectively not following the democratic decisions of the International. And then a great big fight broke out between Marx and the anarchists, which each one accusing the other of being authoritarian and democratic, et cetera, et cetera. And we don't have to replay that whole debate here, but what's very clear is that Marx never differed, I don't think, and certainly not the end of his life, from 1871 onward. He didn't differ with the anarchists over a critique of the nature of the state. What he differed from the anarchists on was the question of whether to abolish the state can it be done prior to the transformation of the fundamental political economy of capital. Because if you put aside the question of political economy or minimize that and turn revolution into a purely political exercise, then you're failing to dig out and overcome the roots of the problem of statism to begin with. So it's not a question for him of should there or should there not be a state. That's not where the difference comes in as much as what is involved in the abolition of the state and how is it going to be achieved. Lastly, I have to mention that Marx had bigger fights, however, with his own followers than he had with the anarchists, in the sense that the most prominent socialist of Marx's time in Germany was Ferdinand LaSalle, who was the organizer and leader of the first independent German workers' organization. And for 50, 60 years after his death, was widely heralded in the European labor movement as being the organizational superior of Marx. Marx, however, denounced LaSalle as the future workers' dictator, and was very, very put off by LaSalle's conception that socialism has to be brought into existence through an accommodation with the existing state. So there's on two poles here, the anarchists on one side, the LaSallians on the other. Much of Marx's energies in the last years of his life was actually devoted to polemicizing against the LaSallians, and he was very upset with his own followers, the so-called Marxists, a few of them that they were around at the time, who merged into LaSalle's party in 1875, created a new party, which Marx denounced in the Critique of the Gotha Program, precisely on the issue of their accommodation to a statist conception of socialism.
Well, trying to probe a bit more into Marx's vision of the future to the degree to which that can be pieced together, for a lot of people, the notion of socialism or communism is synonymous with the state because of the experience of the 20th century. But also because there is a tendency for people to understand socialism and communism as simply a transformation of the economy, of the society, as you've touched on earlier. So bearing that in mind, how did Marx conceive of a planned economy, which again has been sort of synonymous with these things, in a society in which the state has withered away?
Right. Marx's main point here is that what's really driving the problem of capitalism is that we are not in control of our own activity. Okay? There's a social force that governs our productive and reproductive activity, which is completely indifferent to our sensuous needs and social necessities and human character. And that is what he calls abstract socially necessary labor time. That is, that the value of a commodity in capitalism is actually not determined by the amount of time it takes to create a given commodity. That is, the actual amount of time it takes to create it. The amount of time that it takes to create a commodity may vary in different situations, but the value of that commodity is determined by the social average of time that is necessary to create it. So if it takes 20 hours to produce a car in Detroit, to assemble a car in Detroit, but it takes 14 hours to produce the same car in, say, China, the extra 6 hours that the Detroit worker forms does not actually, from a capitalist point of view, create any value. That 20 hours to be brought down to 14 has to conform to the socially necessary labor time as established by the world market, which means that there's constantly a drive on the part of capitalism to get people to conform to an abstract average outside of anyone's control, including the capitalists. Because how the socially necessary average established is through technological innovation. You come up with a new device, it lowers the amount of time it takes to create a product, you increase productivity, and therefore you increase profit. But anybody who doesn't introduce that new device and keep up with your new level of socially necessary labor time to create that commodity is essentially eventually driven out of business through competition. So there's this constant force that's pressuring producers, both the worker and the capitalist, to conform to this abstract socially necessary labor time, this abstract average. And that's what creates value, not the actual labor time worker performs, but the labor time the worker performs that is in conformity with this abstract average. Now, I mention all of this because what's understanding is that once this domination of socially necessary labor time over the laborer is abolished, that is, the laborers themselves determine what should be produced, how should it be produced, and what time it should produce based on their given needs and desires and the needs of their community, and they're no longer governed by this abstract average. Okay, so you have a freely democratic control of that productive process and reproductive process. You no longer have time confronting the labor as a person apart. You now have a more freely associated organization of time based on people's actual actions and actual abilities. And that frees up an entire realm of possibility for human expansion that doesn't exist under capitalism, where everything basically becomes driven more and more to by this drive for conforming to the social average. And so Marx's understanding, therefore, of what would change in such a society is that, on the one hand, we would organize our time so that we would not have to produce an endless, infinite amount of commodities to produce an endless, infinite amount of value. We're no longer governed by a force that compels us to constantly follow that dictate. We now can organize our time and our productive resources to meeting the needs that we have and to reducing our labor time to the minimal point necessary so that we can spend the rest of our lives doing what's really important to us, which is areas of creativity and interaction that are outside of work, whether it's cultural pursuits or social responsibilities or simply the pleasures of everyday life. And therefore, as Marx put it, a truly socialist society is one that tries to ensure the manifestations of a totality of manifestations of human existence, that tries to explore the many different forms of human sensuous experience and tries to give free rein to its multiple possibilities. This doesn't really exist under a capitalist society, however, where everything is reduced to really one sense, and that is the sense of increasing monetary output, increasing profit, increasing production for the sake of simply increasing production.
Peter Hudis is my guest. He teaches humanities and philosophy at Oakton Community College. He's the general editor of the Complete Works of Rosa Luxemburg, and we're talking to him about Marx's concept of the alternative to capitalism. That's the name of his latest book. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, staying with this question of how Marx saw a post-capital society and the way that the people who would inhabit it, the producers, would structure the society, one of the things that you argue in the book is that not thinking about future visions has impeded radical movements in the present, that there seems to be no alternatives that are conceivable, and we have almost a constrained vision of what might be possible. And one of the places where this comes up, where thinking about the future often breaks down and people content themselves to just trying to work within the limits of the system, is around the ecological crisis, which, although some have pointed to Marx's awareness of ecological issues, obviously he did not witness the kind of full-fledged kind of ecological crisis that we're seeing now on a global level. And so in terms of thinking about social organization as Marx conceived of it in a future after capitalism, one of the objections that could be raised would be this notion of people freely associating and then sort of figuring out what they would like and how they might shape their lives. might work on a local level or a citywide level, Paris Commune obviously taking place at the level of a city. But when you're talking about crises that happen on the global level, do you think that these notions that he had would be utopian in the negative sense?
Well, I don't think Marx has a worked out comprehensive answer to the question of what constitutes a post-capitalist society. I think that he has a concept of a post-capitalist society that has important elements that can enable us to answer to provide that comprehensive conception. But it's the foundation for working out the problem. It's not the answer to the problem. Just the foundation. It's not the building. Okay? So now you're really asking a question about the building. And Marx really doesn't give us much directly about the question of how do you actually organize on a systemic level a society that's no longer based on the domination of socially necessary labor time, but is based on new human relations in which human relations no longer take a finger-formed or abstract form of domination. But he does give us enough elements that we can think the matter out somewhat. I mean, I think one of the really exciting things we've seen in the last several decades is the very interesting experiments that have occurred on a grassroots level of workers' cooperatives, neighborhood cooperatives, efforts to establish different forms of association and production on at least localized levels. Talk about anything from what happened in Argentina in 2000 and 2001 to a lot of the things that have been occurring in the Bolivian highlands among the Aymara peoples and the struggles around indigenous rights and ecological preservation in those areas. So there's a lot of things we can learn from different parts of the world that have tried to develop what is principles of a free kind of associated production that I think fits very appropriately to kind of conception of an alternative to capitalism that's needed for today. The systemic question of how you think about that in terms of it running a society as a whole, well, you're going to have, obviously, national coordination, indeed international coordination, in order to make sure that these cooperatives do not exist as little islands in a sea of capitalism, but actually, you know, lead the way to a systemic transformation of capitalism as a global system. And one of the key things that's important for that, though, is the question of the inseparability of democracy and socialism. Because if you try to create any sort of systemic socialistic form of social organization that is not thoroughly democratically controlled by those who are the agents of this social transformation, you're just creating the pathway to a new form of class society. So the question of democracy cannot be passed over as just bourgeois liberalism or a relic from a previous period of Enlightenment reason. It has to be integrated very directly into one's conception of how to organize a post-capitalist society. And that's, I think, one of the things that's missing in a lot of the discussions today, where the legacy of what Rosa Luxemburg certainly comprehended, that there can be no socialism without democracy, but there also can't be any true democracy without socialism, is far too often forgotten about. There are ways to organize democratically on a systemic level based on free consultation and association without leading to a new hierarchy rising above it. And we don't have any roadmap as to exactly how to do that in all the details, but I think we have technological developments and innovations and communicative strategies that have developed in the last several decades that actually make that project a lot easier today than it ever would have existed in Marx's time. But we have to approach the subject with an understanding that the two sides of democracy and socialism have to be together from the beginning. Otherwise, the task is not going to be possible.
In the stolid readings of Marx and the often doctrinaire notions of socialism that dominated in the 20th century, stagism was a theme that you go from capitalism to socialism to communism, and you go through these stages, and then you finally get to the glorious society. How much of that actually comes from Marx?
Some of it does, and most of it doesn't. Marx went through a development on this as well. And if you read his earlier writings in the 1840s and early 1850s on this, there was a stagified conception of development in Marx, where he sees this kind of historical sequence of feudalism, capitalism, socialism, communism. I should correct that. he never made a distinction of socialism and communism. That was a later development. There is no distinct socialist or communist stage in Marx's writings, but there was earlier in his work a kind of notion that this is these historical stages, feudalism, capitalism, socialism slash communism, right? The two mean the same thing, the latter two, to Marx. That distinction of the two only comes in Lenin and later thinkers. But by the late 1850s, and definitely by the 1870, Marx has radically changed that position. By the second German edition of Capital, for instance, Marx makes it very clear that his analysis of the development of capitalism in that book is restricted specifically to the historical development of Western Europe. And it's not a universal theory that is intended to predict or normatively establish the path that all societies have to go through. So he actually, at the end of his life, begins to see that the possibility of technologically underdeveloped societies in the non-Western world reaching a socialist communist society without having to go through the vicissitudes of a prolonged period of capitalism. And he modifies quite substantially some of his earlier kind of unilinear evolutionism to now take account of the fact in certain societies, there are communal indigenous formations, or it's a kind of proto-socialism, and that there is a kind of socialism before capitalism that gets abolished by the course of capitalist development. So he's very much, in that sense, arguing in his later writings that if that kind of incipient socialistic form of social organization that's being undermined in the non-Western world but still exists there could be rearticulated in conjunction with a socialist revolution elsewhere in the world, especially the technologically developed West, it would be possible for many of these societies, especially Russia that he had in mind at the time, to actually bypass a stage of capitalist development. That's something that's developed quite a bit in Kevin Anderson's book, Marx in the Margins. I've also written about this in my piece on Marx Among the Muslims, tracing out Marx's writings on Islam and Islamic societies near the end of his life, where he showed a newfound appreciation for a possible independent path to socialism that didn't proceed through this kind of unilinear evolutionist stage. But you have to understand, this was all lost upon his followers. His writings on this were either not known, and what were known was pretty much ignored, because by the time people encountered them in the early 20th century, they already had a conception of what Marxism was, quote-unquote Marxism, putting scare quotes around it. Marxism for them was this stageified theory, and anything that looked different from that was simply dismissed to a large degree. And now we know much better, we see that it's a much more complex development on Marx's part than has been presumed heretofore.
Well, let me end by asking you then about whether you see Marx's writings on a post-capitalist society as being future-oriented or not. And I say that because you were just talking about his notion that at least in some societies there were communal forms that had been preserved that perhaps could be tapped for life beyond capitalism, but really more specifically since the world that we live in now is predominantly capitalist. So those debates over those things are less relevant. Marx saw freedom as partially, anyway, connected to the ability to create a society where the forces of production were developed and could lay the basis for a different kind of political economic foundation for the society, obviously, not just as narrowly as I stated it. But you also raised the question of whether the issue for us now is developing the forces of production or limiting the forces of production given the crisis point that we're in ecologically. Obviously, Marx lived in his time. You know, he didn't live now. He didn't have a crystal ball into the future. But would you say that his notion of life beyond capitalism was a future-oriented notion, and now is that something that we can still embrace?
Yes, but with one big reservation, and that is that it's understandable, perhaps even out of necessity, that in much of his work, Marx does emphasize the material condition, one of the main material conditions being needed for a successful socialist society or communist society, is the developed forces of production. That is, he never believed you can create socialism in one country. He also never thought you can create socialism, a socialism of poverty. There had to be a certain level of material development in order to allow for what we call a totality of manifestations of life. If we have to work, if we have to spend 3-4 hours a day fetching our own water, if we have to spend 50-60 hours a week of our time engaged in all kinds of labor that could be readily made redundant by the use of technology, how are we going to be able to create the new human personality that's necessary for a socialist or communist future? But that was necessary for him to emphasize in his time when the capitalism was, so to speak, just beginning to show itself and had not dominated the entire world, and the forces of production were relatively underdeveloped. But we're living in a very different world today in which we have still in a certain sense that problem, but in a certain sense the opposite. That is, much of the world remains horribly underdeveloped. 90% of humanity is living under, close to that, is living under $10 a day. There are conditions of real material deprivation that have to be resolved. So there is no question that development, economic development, is a necessity. But at the same time, there's also, we have to look at the way the force of production have no longer really geared to augment the improvement of people's lives in a real material, let alone spiritual sense. They're simply being augmented for the sake of the augmentation or the accumulation of capital. And it's become such an end in itself that the forces of production are so enormous and so complex and so much a concentration of wealth that it's causing enormous ecological destruction. So in a certain sense, the forces of production in some contexts have to be radically taken down. It's not developing the forces of production. It's also destroying some of these forces of production and freeing ourselves from them that it's going to be needed in order to save the planet and have an effective socialist or communist society. So you're not going to get a lot of that from Marx himself, but that is a conception that obviously the realities of our age require us to emphasize. But the general principles of Marx's conception of a post-capitalist society not only still apply, they apply even more so given the qualification that I just mentioned. Because what's the fundamental core of this notion of achieving a social society is not the increase of productive forces per se. For him, that was an important one aspect, but it wasn't the sole or the overriding aspect. The overriding aspect is to break from abstract forms of domination by having the control of the social process of production and reproduction by the very agents who are engaged in that process. And communal, collective control, democratically and freely, by the mass of the population, of their own means of existence and means of subsistence. That is what allows for not only political but economic democratic system in which the expansionary drive of capital is challenged and halted, and the tendency of people to think that their lives are meaningful insofar as they accumulate so much material possessions is also halted, because it's precisely because we're not in control of our collective social existence and we feel alienated from it, that we try to compensate for our lack and our emptiness by pursuing the enrichment of material goods and commodities as an end in itself, which, of course, has everything to do with the ecological crisis. So I think that it's the specific understanding he has of breaking from abstract forms of domination in favor of a truly democratic form of social organization based on the self-activity of the producer that becomes more relevant for the future than ever before. But we have to do so with the acknowledgement that there is a kind of productivism in some of Marx's work in terms of emphasizing the importance of the forces of production that have to be reconfigured today in terms of actually qualitatively as well as quantitatively transforming them. That means that we're going to have to make do with a very different way of doing things and making things. We're going to make do with a very different way of living in order for the environment to really be sustainable. And I think that's the real challenge that has to be worked out pretty soon.
Indeed. I've been speaking with the author of Marx's Concept of the Alternative to Capitalism. That's published by Haymarket, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Peter Hudas teaches humanities and philosophy at Oakton Community College. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.